we come to chapter 18 of the Gospel of John. Having worked through the previous 17 chapters, we have been really involved with the events of Holy Week since about the middle of the Gospel of John. In chapter 12, verse 23, Jesus said, "His hour has come." He said that about the time he's entering the city of Jerusalem, the beginning of Passion Week. Then on the Thursday night, he gathered his disciples in the upper room to celebrate the Passover and essentially declares again, "My hour has come." And he knows that his hour has come, but he also knows that it is his hour to endure and his hour alone. He knows that everyone around him is going to fail him. He knows that they're all going to flee. We read in Matthew 26, verse 31. "Then Jesus said to them, 'You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike down the shepherd and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee.' But Peter said to him, 'Even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away.' Jesus said to him, 'Truly, I say to you that this very night, before a rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' Peter said to him, 'Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you.' And all the disciples said the same thing too." So from chapter 13 through to 17, we've had the last night of Christ's life revealed to us on earth. He's been teaching his disciples in the upper room about the establishment of the Lord's table. He's turned the celebration of Passover into the communion service. He's been teaching, encouraging, and making promises to his disciples in the upper room. They leave, and he continues to teach and encourage them as they work their way through the city of Jerusalem. He stops and he prays in chapter 17. And he prays to the Father. And what he prays to the Father is that the Father would fulfill all the promises he's made, that the Father will bring to the fulfillment all the work that he has done. But the time for teaching is past. And we find him in chapter 18 moving directly into the point of his arrest. And so I'll ask Bridget and Brian to come up and read chapter 18 for us.
Jesus had spoken these words. He went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden in which he entered with his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, 'Whom do you seek?' They answered him, 'Jesus, the Nazarene.' He said to them, 'I am he.' And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. So when he said to them, 'I am he,' they drew back and fell to the ground. Therefore he asked again, 'Whom do you seek?' And they said, 'Jesus, the Nazarene.' Jesus answered, 'I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these go their way, to fulfill the word which he spoke, 'Of those whom you have given me, I lost not one.' Simon Peter then, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear, and the slave's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, 'Put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?' So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people.
Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest, but Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. Then the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the slaves and officers were standing there, having made a charcoal fire, for it was very cold, and they were warming themselves, and Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said." When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?" So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, so they said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter had cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter then denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early, and they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Therefore Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." So Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." To fulfill the word of Jesus, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I might not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this world." Therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I release someone to you at the Passover. Do you wish then that I release for you the king of the Jews?" So they cried out again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber.
So we come to John chapter 18, where we have the narrative of the arrest and trial of Jesus. There are six aspects to the trial of Jesus: free religious and free civil. And to put the whole picture together, we have to pull some information from all four Gospels as we go through. The free religious trials went something like this. First, to Annas, and that was a sort of preliminary hearing in the middle of the night. Annas sends him to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, but whilst it's still dark. They reconvene again after daybreak and have a public trial in front of Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin to make it look all legal. But after that, there were three civil trials. They sent him to Pilate. Pilate sent him to Herod. And Herod sends him back to Pilate. So six different elements to the trial. So starting at verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of Kidron, where there was a garden in which he entered, which is with his disciples. So as we've just been talking about, his disciples have been with him all evening. They've been with him pretty much all week. They follow him out of the upper room earlier that evening. He's teaching them as they walk through Jerusalem in the darkness. They stop to hear him as he prays in John 17. And then they head towards this garden on the Mount of Olives. The other gospel writers tell us that it was called the Garden of Gethsemane. But the reason he went there is because he knew that place, that was the place where Judas was coming to. Luke tells us that it's been his habit during Passion Week. In Luke 21, verse 37. Now, during the day he was teaching in the temple, but at evening he would go out and spend the night on the mount that is called Olivet. Now, the leaders of Israel have wanted to get him for some time, but they have feared the people. He's popular. He's dangerous. But here, Jesus has made it easy for them. Jesus has informed the authorities through Judas that he would be there. And that's why Jesus went there. His hour has come. It's time for the good shepherd to lay down his life for his sheep. Luke tells us that when he got there, he prayed. And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and began to pray, saying, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done." Now an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthening him, and beginning in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. You see, he knew exactly what was awaiting him. He knew precisely what was going to happen, but yet he can pray, "Yet not my will, but yours be done." In verse 2, now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So a Roman cohort consists of about 600 men. It could just have been a detachment from the cohort, a maniple, but that still would amount to approximately 200 men. And then we have to add into that numerous temple guards. This is a significant number of people, and they've come armed. They're ready for trouble. They know Jesus is popular, and they don't want things to get out of hand. Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us Judas goes up and kisses Jesus on the face, the traditional kiss of affection. Then in verse 4 of John's Gospel, so Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. So Jesus doesn't wait for anybody to say anything. He's the first one to speak. "Judas, are you going to betray me with a kiss?" And then he faces them and says, "Whom do you seek?" Now he knows everything that's about to happen. He went forth even though he knows what's about to happen. He's known as the Son of God from the beginning of eternity. And he's told his disciples about this. In Matthew 16, verse 21, from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. He knew exactly every single detail of what was going to happen to him. But in verse 6, so when he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell on the ground. All these soldiers, temple guards, religious leaders, they fall to the ground. They've come armed to the teeth, ready to deal with a difficult situation, and all he has to do is speak to them, and they fall to the ground. This is his power, The point of it is that this is not a helpless victim. He has complete control over everything that's going on. Therefore, he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these others go their way, to fulfill the word which he spoke. Of those whom you have given me, I have lost none." So he repeats the question. They repeat their question, and he answers them, "I told you that I am he." But the point he's making here is this: if you seek me, then you have to let these others go. You've just acknowledged twice that you only have authority to come and arrest me, Jesus the Nazarene. So then he says, let these go their way. So even at the night of his betrayal, he seeks to protect them out of the love that he has for them, because he knows that if they were arrested and had to suffer what he is to suffer, they would fail and they would be lost. But then all of a sudden, to the disciples, it must have seemed like the time for action was finally here. Mark 14 tells us they laid hands on him and seized him. In response to this, John tells us that Peter reacts violently. In verse 10, Simon Peter, then having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. And the slave's name was Malchus. Peter draws his sword, takes a whack at the head of Malchus, who's just a slave of the high priest. Malchus must have had a good reaction because he only lost an ear. But it seems like the war for the Messiah has finally begun. But then in verse 11. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" "Put that sword away, Peter." He's saying, we're not here to fight. But this is not a victim speaking. This is the all-glorious Son of God willingly giving himself up in our place. "The Father has given me this cup to drink for the sake of all the people he has given me. Shall I not drink it?" And then, in his divine righteousness, in the other Gospels, we're told that the Lord performs his last known miracle before the cross, where he heals the servant's ear. Mark 14. "And they all left him and fled. The game's up. The revolution failed. You best get out of here pretty quick." Verse 12. "So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas. First, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it is expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people." So who is Annas? In verse 19, he's identified as the high priest. But we've just read here in verse 13, it says Caiaphas is the high priest that year. Seems to be a bit of a problem. But it's not really. It's sort of like the way the Americans do it with the president. Once you're a president, you're always referred to as a president, even if you've left office. But according to Numbers 35, a high priest was supposed to be a high priest for life. However, the Romans didn't like that idea because they feared that it gave some man just too much time to acquire power that might be a threat to them. And so they were always looking to replace the high priest so that no one man would accumulate too much power. They didn't get that far, however, because the subsequent high priests after Annas were five of his sons, one of his grandsons, which meant he was always the patriarchal high priest behind the scenes, and from the vantage point of the people, was probably regarded as the legitimate high priest. The Romans have run out of immediate relatives, and so now they've appointed a man named Caiaphas, who is Annas' son-in-law. In John 11, we hear of Caiaphas. Verse 48, if we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish. He was saying, we don't need to sit around until we have a war going on before we act, and people start dying, and we get removed from power, maybe even killed. All we have to do is kill this one man, and the problem's solved. When they arrest him, they have full intention of fulfilling the words of Caiaphas. The idea is, it's going to be him that dies, and not all of us. Continuing in verse 15 of John. Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. Then the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, you are not also one of this man's disciples, are you? He said, I am not. So at the arrest in the garden, they all fled. But it's clear that Peter and another disciple have found their way back in the dark. He's following Jesus, but he doesn't want anybody to know about it. He loves Jesus just enough to not leave. So he seeks a hiding place where he can watch and follow on what's going on. And we're told he's not alone. In verse 15, it says there was another disciple. Some people think the other disciple here was John. But as we have no name, we cannot be completely sure. So Peter is outside. The other disciple didn't see him come in with him. So he went back out, spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. Then the slave girl looks at him and says, you're not also one of this man's disciples, are you? It's not really someone to fear, surely, some slave girl at the gate. But he says, I am not. Now, this was his first denial of Christ. And it's all started with a lie to a slave girl. And this is the very man on that very night who has said that he would die with Christ. In verse 18, now the slaves and the officers were standing there having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold and they were warming themselves. And Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself. Now, if it was me, I'd have been long gone. We've already had one lie. That's enough. Risk. Thank you very much. Time to go. But Peter is still standing there with the slaves and the officers trying to keep warm. He doesn't want to leave because he does love the Lord. But he doesn't want to be exposed because he also fears for his own safety. In verse 19, we shift back to Jesus' trial once again. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Now, this is a mockery of Jewish justice because it's an essential regulation of Jewish law that a prisoner must not be asked any question which, by answering, would be an admission of guilt. It's sort of as the Americans have with their Fifth Amendment, where a criminal cannot be made to incriminate themselves. So if you're going to find someone guilty, there has to be evidence beyond a self-confession. You can't force someone to confess. But here, Annas, the high priest, who is the judge, says to Jesus, "Tell me about your disciples and your teaching." He has no right to do that. But he wants to know, tell me about your disciples. How many are there? Where are they? He wants to find out how big this insurrection is likely to be. What's he dealing with here? And also, tell me about your teaching. Come on, admit to some form of blasphemy so we can get you. In verse 20, Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. And I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. He's saying to them, bring some witnesses. Do this legally. I didn't do anything in secret. You've spent the week listening to my teaching. Every day in the temple, in the open, in the public, find somebody to comment on my teaching. Now, Jesus is not being uncooperative here. He's simply asking for normal, just, legal treatment. He knows he's not going to get it, but he wants to expose the illegality of this event. In verse 22, when he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? Now, this is the first ever recorded blow inflicted against his sacred body. He's received it from the hand of sinners. It came from a Jew. The Greek term used here literally means to give a blow to the face. But Jesus calmly responds. Jesus answered him, if I've spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me? Where is the testimony? You're indicting me, you're hitting me in the face. For what? Where are your witnesses? Where is the testimony against me? Now, if these were true, just judges of the law, at this point they would have to release him because there are no witnesses, there is no evidence, there's basically no crime. But they can't release him because they want him dead. So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So the Sanhedrin is assembled with Caiaphas in the chamber in the dead of night, which is again against Jewish law, to try someone at night time. They pull together some false witnesses in the trial before Caiaphas. We read about them in Matthew 26, verse 60. But later on, two came forward and said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. And then in Matthew 26, verse 63, the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his robes and says, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they answered, he deserves death. In John's gospel, he now switches us back to Peter's denial. In verse 25, now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, you are not also one of his disciples, are you? He denied it and said, I am not. One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, said, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter then denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. We read about it in Luke 22, verse 61. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him, before a rooster crows today, you will deny me 3 times. And he went out and wept bitterly. So that's all for the second phase of his religious trial. The next was to come after dawn. And then, after that, in verse 28, they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. So they won't go in themselves because they don't want to be defiled by entering the house of a Gentile and be prevented from eating the Passover. But that's not in the law of God. Numbers 19 forbids the touching of a dead body. That would defile you. But according to the Mishnah, the codification of Jewish law by that time, it read that the dwelling place of Gentiles are unclean. They have invented things like this to isolate themselves from the Gentiles. In verse 29, therefore Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" Pilate assumes there has to be some sort of a crime, but what crime? And of course, this starts to become a bit of a problem for the Jewish leaders because they don't really have a crime. They don't really want Pilate to be a judge. They want Pilate to be their executioner. They don't want justice for Jesus. They want him dead. In verse 30, they answered it and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." So he's asked them what accusation there is against Jesus, and they respond by accusing him of questioning their integrity. "Are you insulting us? As if we would bring to you a man to be executed who hadn't committed a crime. We wouldn't have brought him to you if he wasn't guilty, now would we? He is an evildoer. You don't need to know any more. Please kill him for us." In verse 31, so Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "We're not permitted to put anyone to death." To Pilate, this is just some Jewish thing. Sort it out yourselves. Rome has no interest here. What does your law say? If you've got some crime against him, do whatever you need to do according to your law. And in effect, Pilate is saying, I give you permission. Rome's okay with it. Do what you want. But the Jews say to him, "We're not permitted to put anyone to death because it would be a violation of Roman law." "Oh no, we're not permitted because we're bound by Roman law." Why are they trying to force this issue through Pilate, through Herod, back to Pilate? Verse 32 gives us the answer. It is to fulfill the word of Jesus which he spoke, signifying by what death he was about to die. Because back in John 12, verse 32, "And if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself." And that's how Romans execute criminals. They lifted them up on the cross. The Jews, however, throw men down and stone them on the ground. In verse 33, therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me? Are you the king of the Jews? Is that your charge, Pilate? I'm in your court. Are you the one actually charging me with something? Is this your idea, that I'm some sort of insurrectionist, that I'm leading some sort of attempt against Rome? Is it your idea, or are you just some sort of errand boy for the Jewish leadership?" In verse 35, Pilate answered, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" So to Pilate, once again, this is some sort of Jewish issue that has nothing to do with military or politics. Now, Pilate is aware that the Jews would welcome a real military leader type king who would try to overthrow Rome. But he still doesn't know what Jesus has done. Then Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. Yes, I am a king, but not in the sense you know to be a king. Yes, I am a king, but my kingdom is not from this world. It doesn't originate in this world. In fact, it's got nothing to do with this world. So I'm no threat to you or to Rome's temporal authority or its military power. Only people threatened by Jesus are the corrupt religious leaders of Israel." Therefore, Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify of the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. I was born." That's the incarnation. That's his humanity. Then he says he came into the world effectively from glory. That's describing his deity. And why has he done it? To testify to the truth, because he is the King of truth. His kingdom is truth. And he says, everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Pilate says to him, what is truth? Now, John does not cover all of the detail of the trial before Pilate. Luke's gospel tells us that Pilate sends him to Herod, and when he discovers that Jesus is from Galilee and so under Herod's jurisdiction, he's once again trying to get rid of this problem and give it to somebody else. Herod questions Jesus at some length, but he answered him nothing. And after mistreating Jesus, Herod sent him back to Pilate, where we pick up once again with John. Verse 38. And when he said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish that I release for you the King of the Jews? So they cried out again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. So Pilate is still trying to find a way out of this problem. Because Jesus is innocent. And he cannot see the Roman law, the Roman law courts mocked by the Jewish leaderships, using it to put an innocent man to death. He has to uphold the honor of Rome. But he has an idea. It's Passover. I can release someone, as is the custom. But they would rather have an actual murderer be released than an entirely innocent Jesus. Later in chapter 19, Pilate has him scourged. Then again comes to the Jews in verse 4 and says, I'm bringing him out to you so you may know I find no guilt in him. Then in verse 6, the chief priests and the officers saw him and they cried out saying, crucify him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, take him away yourself and crucify him. I find no guilt in him. So in chapter 18, we have this narrative of the faultless, righteous Lamb of God permitting himself to be arrested. He is the King of truth, but he allows himself to be falsely accused in what can only be described as a first century version of a Stalinist show trial, where the outcome is predetermined. It's death. The fact that he's innocent means nothing. Despite his awesome power, he allows himself to be mistreated and later on executed. And he suffers all of that alone, abandoned by all, even Peter. And while he's actually going to the cross, they're still sinning against him, the very ones he dies to save. But what you see through the whole of this is his glorious perfection. Throughout it, the Son loves the Father just as the Father loves the Son, and the Son is willingly obedient to the will of the Father. Yet not my will, but yours be done. And it is well that Christ was abandoned by all, because no one can claim any of the glory. All of the glory of his victory is his. Imagine for a moment the conceited pride of Peter if he had in any way contributed to Christ's victory. But he can have none at all because the victory is Christ's and Christ's alone. As a result, Peter's need of grace was no less greater than our own. And Christ in his mercy restores Peter. At the end of the Gospel of John, he asked Peter 3 times, do you love me? One for every instant of denial. And each time Peter said, Lord, I love you. And he restored him to ministry. And Peter preached a great sermon on the day of Pentecost. But he could boast of nothing for himself. He could only trust in the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and give to him all the glory for the work of salvation. We give thanks for that. Amen. So now we have our closing hymn, number 465, Meekness and Majesty.